My mask's rubber seals had cracked months ago, letting wisps of toxic vapor seep through gaps I'd patched with synthetic flesh and prayer strips. Down here in the bowels of Hive Primus, proper equipment was a luxury none of us could afford. I adjusted the straps cutting into my scarred cheeks and checked my chronometer. The main sump pump had been running rough for weeks, its ancient machinery grinding against blockages that threatened to back up the entire lower district's waste flow. The guilders paid well for clearing these jams, but only because most crews didn't survive long enough to collect more than a few payments. The work killed men in dozens of ways: toxic exposure, crushing pressure, drowning in chemical sludge, or simply getting lost in the maze of corroded pipes that stretched for kilometers beneath the hive's foundation. My crew waited behind me at the access hatch, their breathing apparatus wheezing in the recycled air. Corvin stood closest, his massive frame squeezed into an enviro suit that had seen better decades. The fabric showed patches of different colors where he'd sewn on replacement sections, creating a patchwork that made him look like some underhive jester. His rebreather was military surplus, probably stripped from a corpse in the ash wastes, but it functioned better than most equipment down here. The man had worked construction in the mid-hive before a manufactorum accident crushed his left leg, leaving him with a permanent limp that relegated him to underhive labor. Thane crouched beside a toolkit filled with jury-rigged cutting implements. His hands moved constantly, checking and rechecking the plasma torch he'd assembled from salvaged components. The device looked like it might explode at any moment, its housing cracked and held together with industrial adhesive, but Thane had a gift for making broken technology function just long enough to complete a job. His enviro suit was the worst of the group, more patches than original material, and I could see where chemical burns had eaten through the fabric near his shoulders. The man never complained, though his coughing fits were getting worse each month. Dex sat against the tunnel wall, his thin frame nearly lost in an oversized suit that had probably belonged to someone twice his size. He'd stuffed rags into the empty spaces to prevent the garment from sliding off his shoulders. His rebreather was homemade, cobbled together from scavenged parts and sealed with whatever waterproof materials he could find. The boy was maybe 17, though malnutrition and chemical exposure made it hard to tell. He'd joined the crew 6 months ago after his family died in a sump gas leak, and the underhive had already started marking him with its particular brand of wear. Vask completed our group, his scarred face visible through a cracked visor that he refused to replace. He claimed the spider web of fractures helped him judge distances better, though I suspected he simply couldn't afford new equipment. His cutting tools were the most reliable of the bunch, maintained with an obsession that bordered on religious devotion. The man had been a gang enforcer before a rival house put a price on his head, forcing him to disappear into the anonymous depths of the sump tunnels. His enviro suit was reinforced with metal plates he'd welded onto the chest and back, giving him the appearance of some primitive knight. The tunnel stretched ahead of us, its walls weeping with condensation that carried the chemical signature of a dozen different manufactorum processes. Overhead, massive pipes ran parallel to our path, their surfaces green with corrosion and bacterial growth that fed on the toxic compounds flowing within. The constant drip of runoff had carved channels in the rockcrete floor, creating pools of multicolored sludge that bubbled with gases that could blind a man or stop his heart. Emergency lighting strips flickered sporadically, casting shifting shadows that made navigation treacherous. The hum of machinery permeated everything, a low vibration that traveled through the tunnel walls and into our bones. Somewhere above us, the manufactorums churned out weapons and ammunition for the Imperial War Machine, their waste products flowing down through layers of processing systems that hadn't received proper maintenance in centuries. Only the Emperor's blessing kept the ancient pumps and filtration systems functional, though that divine protection seemed to be wearing thin in recent years. I'd learned to read the signs of impending system failure during my decades in the underhive. The way certain pipes sang with dangerous harmonics, the color changes in chemical runoff that indicated pressure buildups, the subtle shifts in airflow that warned of blockages forming in critical junctions. Today felt different, though I couldn't identify exactly what was setting off my instincts. The pump's rhythm seemed more labored than usual, its mechanical heartbeat irregular in ways that suggested serious problems developing in its core systems. We moved deeper into the tunnel network, following maintenance markers that had been painted decades ago and refreshed by countless crews like ours. The path took us through chambers where massive valves controlled the flow of waste between different processing stages. These spaces reeked of sulfur and industrial solvents, their walls stained with chemical deposits that had built up over generations of continuous operation. Ancient warning signs in high Gothic covered every surface, most of them faded beyond readability, though their skull and crossbones imagery remained clear enough. The sound of the main pump grew louder as we approached the central processing chamber. Its rhythm had definitely changed since our last visit, developing a grinding quality that spoke of worn bearings and damaged impellers. The guilders would expect us to clear whatever blockage was causing the problem, but they wouldn't provide better equipment or hazard pay for the increased risk. That was the way of things in the Underhive. Life was cheap, and there were always desperate men willing to take jobs that killed their predecessors. My own equipment reflected years of careful scavenging and maintenance. The rebreather had started life as a mining apparatus designed for use in the ash wastes, but I'd modified it with filters salvaged from a dozen different sources. The Enviro suit was military grade, though its original owner had died violently enough to leave burn marks and puncture wounds that I'd patched with synthetic materials. My cutting tools were the best I could afford, maintained with the same obsessive care that had kept me alive when other crews died around me. The tunnel began to slope downward more sharply, leading us toward the pump chamber's main access point. Water seeped through cracks in the rockcrete, carrying dissolved chemicals that left crystalline deposits on every surface. The air grew thicker, requiring more effort from our struggling rebreathers as they worked to filter out an increasingly toxic atmosphere. Emergency lighting became more sporadic, forcing us to rely on handheld illuminators that cast narrow beams through the chemical haze. I could feel the pump's vibrations through the soles of my boots now, a rhythmic pounding that seemed to shake the entire tunnel system. The blockage had to be significant to cause this much strain on the machinery, which meant we were looking at hours of dangerous work in an environment that could kill us in minutes if our equipment failed. But the payment would keep us fed for weeks, assuming we survived to collect it. The economics of Underhive survival were brutal in their simplicity. A successful job clearing a major blockage might earn each crew member enough thrones to buy food and basic supplies for a month. Failure meant death, usually slow and agonizing as toxic chemicals ate through protective equipment and flesh alike. Success meant living long enough to take the next job, which carried its own lethal risks. It was a cycle that ground men down until they made fatal mistakes or their bodies simply gave out under the accumulated damage of chemical exposure. Behind me, my crew prepared their equipment for the work ahead. I could hear the wheeze of overtaxed rebreathers and the creak of Enviro suits stretched beyond their design limits. These men trusted me to lead them through another job, to make the decisions that would determine whether they returned to their families or died choking on toxic sludge in some forgotten tunnel. The responsibility weighed on me, though I'd learned not to dwell on the mortality statistics of Underhive scavenging crews. The pump chamber access hatch appeared ahead of us, its heavy metal surface streaked with rust and chemical stains. Beyond that barrier lay the heart of the sump system, where massive machinery fought a constant battle against the hive's waste products. We would descend into that mechanical hell and somehow clear whatever obstruction was threatening the entire district's waste processing capability. The hatch seal broke with a wet sucking sound that made my stomach clench. Ancient lubricants mixed with decades of chemical buildup had created a paste that clung to the metal threads like congealed blood. I forced the heavy portal open against the resistance of corroded hinges, their protest echoing through the tunnel behind us. The chamber beyond exhaled a wave of superheated air that fogged my visor instantly, carrying the metallic tang of stressed machinery and something else. A sharp, ozone-like scent that made the hair on my arm stand up beneath the Enviro suit. Pump chamber stretched out before us like the gut of some massive beast. Overhead, pipes thick as a man's torso snaked between support columns, their surfaces slick with condensation that dripped steadily onto the metal grating beneath our feet. The main pump dominated the far end of the space, its housing easily 3 meters tall and twice as wide. The machine's rhythm had grown more erratic since we'd entered the access tunnel, developing a stuttering quality that sent vibrations through the floor plating. I gestured for the crew to spread out and begin their assessment of the blockage. Corvin moved toward the primary intake manifold, his heavy boots clanging against the grating as he navigated around pools of standing fluid that had collected in the chamber's low points. The liquid was a sickly yellow-green color, its surface tension broken by bubbles that rose and popped with tiny hissing sounds. His rebreather wheezed with each breath as he leaned over the manifold housing, examining the access panels that would need to be removed to reach the blockage. Thane unpacked his plasma torch near the secondary flow controls, the device's housing crackling with barely contained energy as he activated its power cells. The torch had been cobbled together from components salvaged across multiple jobs, its mismatched parts held in place by industrial adhesive and prayer strips. Blue-white light flickered from its emitter tip as he tested the ignition sequence, casting dancing shadows across the chamber walls. The acrid smell of ozone grew stronger as the plasma coils heated up, mixing with the chemical vapors already saturating the air. Dex positioned himself near the emergency controls, his thin frame dwarfed by the massive valve wheels and pressure gauges that lined the chamber's control panel. Most of the instrumentation hadn't been calibrated in decades, their readings questionable at best, but they still provided some indication of system pressures and flow rates. The boy's homemade rebreather struggled against the thickening atmosphere, its improvised filters already showing signs of saturation as they worked to process the toxic air. Vask took up position near the main access point to the pump's interior mechanisms. His reinforced enviro suit made him look like some ancient warrior as he examined the heavy bolts that secured the pump housing. Each bolt was easily the size of a man's fist, their threads green with corrosion that had built up over generations of continuous operation. His cutting tools gleamed in the chamber's emergency lighting, their edges honed to razor sharpness despite the harsh conditions they'd endured. The blockage became apparent as soon as Corvin removed the first access panel. A mass of solidified waste material had formed inside the primary intake, its surface hardened into a shell that resembled volcanic rock. Beneath that crust, I could see the telltale shimmer of liquid waste still flowing, but the obstruction was severe enough to reduce the pump's efficiency by at least half. The buildup had probably been forming for months, fed by the constant flow of chemical runoff from the manufactorums above. I moved closer to examine the blockage, noting how the solidified material had bonded to the pipe walls with an almost organic tenacity. The surface was riddled with small holes where gases had escaped during the hardening process, giving it the appearance of pumice stone. But this wasn't natural rock, it was the compressed remnant of countless industrial processes, concentrated into a mass that would resist conventional removal methods. Thane began cutting into the blockage with his plasma torch, the superheated beam slicing through the hardened waste with surprising efficiency. Molten droplets fell from the cut edges, sizzling as they hit the standing fluid below and releasing clouds of vapor that made my eyes water even through the rebreather's protection. The torch's power cell indicator flickered between green and amber, warning that the device was operating near its maximum output capacity. The work progressed slowly as we carved away sections of the blockage, each piece requiring careful removal to prevent it from falling deeper into the pump mechanism. Corvin used a combination of leverage bars and brute force to pry loose chunks free, his massive frame straining against the material's stubborn grip on the pipe walls. Sweat ran down his face inside his rebreather mask, fogging the visor as he worked in the chamber's stifling heat. Dex monitored the pressure readings as we worked, calling out changes in the system's behavior as our efforts affected the flow patterns. The numbers fluctuated wildly, sometimes spiking into dangerous ranges before settling back to merely hazardous levels. His voice was muffled by the homemade rebreather, but the tension in his posture made his concern clear even without words. The first sign of real trouble came when Thane's plasma torch began to sputter. The device's improvised housing couldn't handle the sustained output required to cut through the dense blockage material, and hairline cracks were appearing in the power coupling. Blue sparks leaked from the damaged connections, creating a light show that would have been beautiful if it hadn't represented imminent equipment failure. Vask moved to assist with manual removal of the loosened material, his reinforced suit providing protection as he reached into the partially cleared intake. The work required him to squeeze through narrow openings between pipe sections, his metal-plated enviro suit scraping against the corroded surfaces. Chemical residue from the blockage ate at his gloves, forcing him to work quickly before the protective material failed completely. The pump's rhythm grew more labored as we worked, its mechanical heartbeat developing an irregular stutter that sent concerning vibrations through the chamber floor. Each pulse of the massive machinery created pressure waves that I could feel in my chest, a reminder of the immense forces contained within the ancient system. The Emperor's blessing had kept these machines running for centuries, but divine protection seemed increasingly fragile in the face of accumulated neglect and abuse. As Corvin levered another chunk of blockage free, I noticed a hairline crack running along the main intake pipe just above our work area. The fissure was barely visible, hidden beneath layers of corrosion and chemical deposits, but it pulsed slightly with each pump cycle. The crack had probably been developing for years, weakened by the constant pressure and chemical exposure that defined life in the underhive's depths. The plasma torch finally gave up with a shower of sparks that illuminated the entire chamber in stark blue-white light. Thane cursed as the device went dead in his hands, its power cells drained and its housing cracked beyond immediate repair. Without the torch, our progress would slow dramatically, forcing us to rely on manual methods that would take hours longer to complete. I was examining the crack more closely when the pipe gave its first warning groan. The sound was deep and resonant, like the death cry of some massive creature, and it seemed to come from the very bones of the hive itself. The hairline fissure suddenly widened, revealing the immense pressure building behind the blockage we'd been steadily removing. The adamantium pipe had been manufactured during the Dark Age of technology, its molecular structure designed to withstand pressures that would crush conventional materials like paper. But millennia of chemical exposure had eaten away at its integrity, creating weak points that could fail catastrophically under stress. The crack spread with frightening speed, racing along the pipe's length as the metal finally surrendered to forces it could no longer contain. When the breach opened, it did so with a sound like thunder trapped in a metal box. The pipe split along a seam that ran for nearly 2 meters, releasing a torrent of pressurized sludge that erupted into the chamber with the force of an artillery barrage. The toxic waste sprayed in all directions, coating surfaces and filling the air with a mist of chemicals that could burn exposed flesh in seconds. Corvin took the initial blast full in the chest, the pressurized sludge hitting him with enough force to knock his massive frame backward against the chamber wall. His enviro suit's patchwork construction couldn't withstand the chemical assault, and I watched in horror as the fabric began to dissolve where the waste had made contact. He struggled to his feet, his movements already becoming sluggish as the toxic compounds began eating through his protective equipment. The chamber filled with toxic mist as the ruptured pipe continued to hemorrhage its contents under immense pressure. Visibility dropped to mere meters as the chemical fog thickened, turning the emergency lighting into dim halos that barely penetrated the poisonous atmosphere. My rebreather's filters began to clog almost immediately, the ancient mechanisms struggling against contamination levels they'd never been designed to handle. Thane dropped his useless plasma torch and scrambled toward the emergency foam dispensers mounted on the chamber walls. The foam was supposed to expand on contact with chemical spills, creating a barrier that could contain toxic waste until proper cleanup crews arrived. But when he activated the system, the foam dissolved almost immediately upon contact with the acidic sludge, its molecular structure breaking down faster than it could form. Dex abandoned his position at the control panel as the rising sludge reached the level of the electrical systems. Sparks flew from flooded circuits, adding the acrid smell of burning insulation to the chamber's already toxic atmosphere. The boy's oversized enviro suit was quickly becoming a liability as the excess fabric absorbed chemical waste, weighing him down and restricting his movement as he tried to reach higher ground. I grabbed a welding kit from our equipment cache, hoping to create some kind of patch for the ruptured pipe. The welding torch ignited with a blue flame that seemed pathetically small against the scale of the disaster unfolding around us. But when I approached the breach, the chemical spray immediately extinguished the flame, the torch's ignition system failing as corrosive vapors ate through its delicate mechanisms. Vasque tried to force one of the emergency valves closed, his reinforced suit providing some protection against the chemical assault. But the valve wheel was corroded solid, its threads seized by decades of neglect and chemical buildup. Even his considerable strength couldn't budge the mechanism, and the metal began to crumble under his grip as the acidic atmosphere ate away at its structural integrity. The pressure behind the breach seemed infinite, fed by the accumulated waste of an entire hive district flowing through the damaged pipe. Our makeshift patches crumbled as fast as we could apply them, the immense hydraulic force tearing through materials that might have held under normal circumstances. The ancient pump continued its labored rhythm, actually making the situation worse by maintaining pressure in the damaged system. My boots began to slip on the grating as the chamber floor disappeared beneath a rising tide of toxic sludge. The metal walkways were becoming treacherous as chemical runoff ate away at their structural supports, creating gaps that could trap a man's foot or leg. The emergency lighting began to fail as electrical systems flooded, plunging sections of the chamber into darkness that made navigation even more dangerous. The crew's equipment was failing systematically as the chemical assault continued. Rebreather filters clogged and burst, forcing us to breathe increasingly toxic air through damaged seals. Enviro suits dissolved at stress points, exposing skin to compounds that could cause chemical burns within seconds of contact. Our tools became useless as metal components corroded and plastic parts melted in the acidic environment. The sound of the pump grew more irregular as the flooding affected its intake systems. Each mechanical pulse sent pressure waves through the toxic sludge, creating currents that made movement through the chamber increasingly difficult. The machine was slowly drowning in the very waste it had been designed to process, its ancient mechanisms finally succumbing to forces that exceeded their operational parameters. The toxic sludge had reached my knees when Corvin started screaming. The sound cut through the mechanical thunder of the ruptured pipe like a blade, high and desperate in a way that made my blood freeze. His massive frame thrashed against the chamber wall where the initial blast had thrown him, but his movements were becoming increasingly uncoordinated as the chemical waste ate through his patchwork enviro suit. I could see the fabric dissolving in real time, revealing patches of reddened skin beneath that bubbled and blistered where the acidic compounds made contact. The big man's rebreather had taken damage in the impact, its cracked housing allowing toxic vapors to seep directly into his lungs. Each breath produced a wet, rattling sound that spoke of tissue damage occurring faster than his body could compensate. His eyes had gone wide behind the fogged visor, pupils dilated with pain and the early stages of chemical poisoning. The military surplus breathing apparatus that had seemed so reliable just minutes ago was now killing him slowly, feeding him measured doses of death with each labored inhalation. Thane had abandoned his position near the emergency foam dispensers and was frantically searching through our equipment cache for anything that might serve as a makeshift patch. His hands shook as he sorted through the collection of jury-rigged tools and salvaged components, discarding items as soon as he realized they wouldn't withstand the chemical assault. The plasma torch lay forgotten at his feet, its housing split open and leaking coolant that mixed with the rising sludge to create new toxic compounds. The chamber's atmosphere had become a visible thing, thick with chemical vapors that refracted the failing emergency lights into prismatic halos. My own rebreather was struggling against contamination levels that exceeded its design parameters by orders of magnitude. The filters made wet, sucking sounds as they processed air that was more poison than oxygen, and I could taste the metallic tang of chemical breakdown products seeping through the deteriorating seals. Dex had climbed onto one of the higher pipe sections, his thin frame allowing him to navigate spaces that would have been impossible for the rest of us. But his oversized enviro suit was working against him, the excess fabric catching on every protrusion and valve housing. The chemical mist was condensing on the suit's surface, creating rivulets of concentrated toxins that ran down the fabric like tears. His homemade rebreather wheezed with each breath, its improvised construction failing faster than the manufactured equipment the rest of us carried. The rising sludge had reached a level where the chamber's electrical systems began failing in cascading waves. Control panels sparked and died as toxic waste flooded their housings, filling the air with the acrid smell of burning insulation and melting components. The emergency lighting flickered more frequently now, creating a strobe effect that made movement disorienting and dangerous. Shadows jumped and shifted with each pulse of illumination, turning familiar equipment into threatening shapes that seemed to move independently. Vask had positioned himself near the main access hatch, but the rising waist level was making retreat increasingly impossible. The reinforced plates he'd welded to his enviro suit provided some protection against the chemical assault, but the joints and seams were already showing signs of degradation. His cutting tools remained sharp despite the hostile environment, their edges gleaming in the intermittent lighting as he searched for something to cut that might improve our situation. The pump's rhythm had become completely erratic now, each mechanical pulse sending pressure, waves through the toxic flood that made standing difficult. The ancient machinery was drowning in the very waste it had been designed to process, its intake systems clogged with debris and chemical precipitates that formed as different compounds mixed in the flooded chamber. The sound it made had changed from the steady heartbeat of functioning equipment to the death rattle of failing mechanisms. I watched Corvin's condition deteriorate with horrifying speed as the chemical exposure took its toll. His movements became increasingly spastic, muscle groups firing at random as neurotoxins interfered with his nervous system. The big man's strength, which had been our primary asset in removing the blockage, was turning against him as uncontrolled contractions sent him thrashing through the toxic sludge. Each movement spread the corrosive waste across more of his body, accelerating the breakdown of his protective equipment. The realization hit me like a physical blow when I saw Thane eyeing Corvin's military surplus rebreather. The device was damaged but still functional, its robust construction providing better protection than any of our other breathing apparatus. Thane's own improvised equipment was failing rapidly, its cobbled together filters already saturated beyond their capacity to provide meaningful protection. The look in his eyes behind the cracked visor spoke of calculations that had nothing to do with brotherhood or loyalty. Dex had noticed the same thing from his elevated position on the pipe network. His movements became more deliberate as he began working his way toward Corvin's location, using his smaller size and agility to navigate through spaces that the larger men couldn't access. The boy's breathing had become labored as his homemade rebreather struggled against the toxic atmosphere, each inhalation requiring visible effort as the filters approached complete failure. The chamber's atmosphere continued to thicken as the ruptured pipe hemorrhaged its contents under immense pressure. Visibility dropped to arm's length in some areas where the chemical fog was densest, turning the space into a maze of half-glimpsed shapes and threatening shadows. The emergency lighting created pools of dim illumination separated by zones of near-total darkness, making it impossible to track the movements of all crew members simultaneously. Vask had begun moving toward Corvin's position as well, his reinforced suit clanking against the metal grating as he waded through the rising sludge. The man's scarred face was barely visible through his cracked visor, but his posture spoke of predatory intent as he closed the distance to our failing crew member. His cutting tools remained ready in his hands, their edges sharp enough to slice through enviro suit fabric or human flesh with equal ease. The toxic waste had reached a level where it began affecting our ability to move normally. The sludge clung to our legs with each step, its viscous consistency requiring significant effort to overcome. Chemical reactions between different waste streams created pockets of varying density and temperature, some areas burning hot enough to cause immediate tissue damage, while others remained relatively cool but far more corrosive. Corvin's thrashing had weakened considerably as the chemical poisoning progressed through his system. His massive frame still possessed dangerous strength, but his coordination was failing as neurotoxins disrupted the signals between his brain and muscles. The military surplus rebreather continued to function despite its damaged housing, providing him with marginally cleaner air than the rest of us were breathing. That small advantage had become the difference between immediate death and a slightly longer struggle for survival. I found myself calculating the same brutal mathematics that I could see playing out in my crew members' movements. Corvin's rebreather represented our best chance of survival, but the big man wasn't going to give it up willingly. His failing condition made him vulnerable, but he was still dangerous enough to seriously injure anyone who tried to take his equipment by force. The bonds of crew loyalty that had held us together through dozens of dangerous jobs were dissolving as rapidly as our protective equipment. Thane reached Corvin first, his approach masked by the mechanical thunder of the failing pump and the hiss of escaping chemical vapors. The big man was barely conscious now, his head lolling as he struggled to process oxygen through his damaged, but still functioning breathing apparatus. Thane's hands moved toward the rebreather's harness straps, his fingers working at the corroded buckles that held the device in place. Corvin's survival instincts triggered even through his chemical-induced stupor. His massive hand closed around Thane's wrist with crushing force, the grip strong enough to snap bones despite his failing coordination. Thane's scream was muffled by his own deteriorating rebreather, but the pain was evident in his body language as he tried to pull free from the bigger man's grasp. Dex dropped from the pipe network onto Corvin's back, his light frame allowing him to avoid the big man's flailing arms. The boy's hands went immediately for the rebreather's secondary straps, trying to work the device free while Corvin was distracted by his struggle with Thane. But the harness was designed to remain secure under extreme conditions, its multiple attachment points requiring deliberate manipulation to release. Vask arrived at the struggle with his cutting tools already drawn. The blades gleamed in the emergency lighting as he assessed the situation, looking for an opportunity to claim the prize without becoming entangled in the violence himself. His scarred face showed no emotion as he watched his crew members tear at each other like animals fighting over carrion. The toxic sludge continued to rise around us as the struggle intensified. The chemical waste was now deep enough to interfere with our movements significantly, its corrosive properties eating away at equipment and exposed skin alike. My own rebreather was making increasingly desperate sounds as its filters approached complete saturation, each breath requiring more effort as the device struggled to extract oxygen from the poisonous atmosphere. Corvin managed to get his other hand around Thane's throat, his fingers closing with enough pressure to crush the smaller man's windpipe. But his coordination was too damaged to maintain the grip effectively, and Thane managed to twist free with movements that spoke of pure desperation. The plasma torch specialist's enviro suit was dissolving where the toxic sludge had splashed during the struggle, revealing skin that was already showing signs of chemical burns. Dex had worked one of the rebreather straps loose, but the device's weight and Corvin's continued struggles made it impossible to remove completely. The boy's own breathing apparatus was failing catastrophically now, its improvised construction no match for the hostile environment. His movements were becoming increasingly frantic as oxygen deprivation began affecting his judgment and coordination. I realized I was moving toward the struggle before I consciously made the decision. Primitive part of my brain had taken over, the same survival instinct that had kept me alive through decades of underhive work. Corvin's rebreather represented life, and everything else had become secondary to claiming that prize. The bonds of crew loyalty that had once seemed unbreakable were revealed as nothing more than convenient arrangements that dissolved the moment survival was at stake. The struggle for Corvin's rebreather had devolved into something barely recognizable as human behavior. I found myself shoulder deep in the toxic sludge, my hands clawing at straps and buckles alongside Thane and Dex, while Vask circled us like a scavenger waiting for his moment. The chemical waste burned through the fabric of my enviro suit at the joints, creating spreading patches of dissolution that exposed my skin to compounds that immediately began eating away at flesh and nerve endings. Corvin's massive frame had gone mostly limp, but his hands still moved with desperate, uncontrolled spasms that caught us across the face and chest with bruising force. His eyes had rolled back until only the whites showed through his cracked visor, and a pink foam bubbled from his mouth where the rebreather seal had failed completely. The military surplus breathing apparatus continued its mechanical rhythm, processing the toxic atmosphere into something marginally less lethal, but the big man was already too far gone to benefit from its protection. I managed to work my fingers under one of the harness straps just as Thane's elbow caught me across the temple. The blow sent stars exploding across my vision and nearly knocked me unconscious into the rising chemical suit. My rebreather made a wet, choking sound as its filters finally gave up entirely, forcing me to breathe air that tasted of metal and acid and death. Each inhalation felt like swallowing liquid fire, the toxic compounds immediately beginning their work on my lung tissue. Dex had gotten both hands on the rebreather itself, but his grip was slipping as the chemical waste dissolved the outer layer of his gloves. The boy's movements had become increasingly erratic as oxygen deprivation affected his nervous system, his coordination failing just when precision was most critical. His homemade breathing apparatus hung around his neck like a broken collar, its improvised components scattered across the flooded chamber floor. The toxic sludge had reached chest level on my crouched position, its corrosive properties eating through my EnviroSuit's torso section with methodical efficiency. I could feel the chemical burn spreading across my ribs and stomach, the sensation like being slowly cooked from the inside out. The waste contained concentrated runoff from a dozen different manufactorum processes, each compound designed to break down organic materials with ruthless effectiveness. Vasque finally made his move when the rest of us were too exhausted to resist effectively. His reinforced suit gave him advantages in mobility and protection that the rest of us had lost as our equipment failed around us. The cutting tool in his right hand moved with surgical precision, slicing through the rebreather's primary harness strap in a single motion that freed the device from Corvin's unresisting body. I lunged for the rebreather as it came free, but Thane intercepted me with a tackle that sent us both crashing into the toxic sludge. The chemical waste closed over my head for a terrifying moment, filling my mouth and nose with compounds that immediately began burning away at mucous membranes and tooth enamel. I fought my way back to the surface, gasping and retching as my body tried to expel the poison I had inadvertently swallowed. The struggle continued in the rising chemical soup, our movements becoming increasingly sluggish as the toxic environment took its toll. Dex managed to grab the rebreather's breathing tube, but Vasque's cutting tool opened a gash across the boy's forearm that sent blood streaming into the corrosive waste. The wound began smoking immediately as the acidic compounds reacted with exposed tissue, creating a chemical reaction that ate deeper into the boy's arm with each passing second. My own condition was deteriorating rapidly as the failed rebreather forced me to breathe air that was more poison than oxygen. The toxic compounds were attacking my respiratory system from the inside, causing my lungs to fill with fluid as the delicate alveolar structures broke down under chemical assault. Each breath produced a wet, rattling sound that reminded me of Corvin's final moments, and I knew I was following the same path toward suffocation. Thane had managed to get his hands on the rebreather, but his grip was failing as chemical burns ate through the protective material of his gloves. The plasma torch specialist's face was a mask of desperation behind his cracked visor, his eyes wide with the knowledge that this device represented his only chance of survival. But his damaged hands couldn't maintain their hold on the slippery apparatus, and it slipped from his grasp back into the toxic sludge. The chamber's emergency lighting was failing systematically as the chemical flood reached critical electrical systems. Sparks flew from submerged control panels, creating brief moments of illumination that revealed the full horror of our situation. The ancient pump continued its labored rhythm somewhere in the darkness, its mechanical heartbeat growing weaker as the toxic waste clogged its intake systems beyond any hope of clearing. I found the rebreather in the chemical soup through desperate groping, my hands working by touch alone as the failing lights plunged us into near total darkness. The device's housing was still intact despite the violence of our struggle, its military-grade construction proving more durable than any of our other equipment. But when I tried to secure it around my face, Vasque's cutting tool opened a line of fire across my back that sent me sprawling forward into the corrosive waste. The toxic sludge was now deep enough that standing required significant effort, the viscous liquid clinging to our legs and restricting movement to a desperate shuffle. The chemical composition had grown more concentrated as different waste streams mixed and reacted, creating compounds that burned through protective equipment and human tissue with equal efficiency. My EnviroSuit had dissolved completely across my chest and shoulders, leaving exposed skin that bubbled and blistered where the acidic waste made contact. Dex made one final grab for the rebreather, but his coordination had failed completely as oxygen deprivation shut down higher brain functions. The boy's movements were purely reflexive now, his nervous system firing random signals that sent his limbs thrashing without purpose or direction. His oversized enviro suit had become a death shroud, its dissolved fabric clinging to his body like a second skin that trapped the corrosive chemicals against his flesh. Thane's struggle ended when his damaged lungs finally gave up their attempt to process the toxic atmosphere. The plasma torch specialist's body went rigid for a moment before collapsing face first into the chemical soup, his cracked rebreather releasing a final hiss of escaping air as the seals failed completely. The toxic waste immediately began its work on his exposed face and head, the acidic compounds eating away at features that had been recognizable just moments before. I managed to secure the military surplus rebreather around my face just as Vask's cutting tool found my kidney. The blade penetrated what remained of my enviro suit and sank deep into flesh, sending waves of agony through my nervous system that nearly caused me to lose consciousness. But the rebreather's filters began their work immediately, processing the toxic atmosphere into something my damaged lungs could actually use. The difference was like switching from drowning to merely suffocating slowly. Vask's reinforced suit gave him mobility advantages that the rest of us had lost, but his cutting tools were becoming less effective as the chemical waste ate away at their metal components. The blades that had seemed so sharp and dangerous were now pitted and corroded, their edges dulled by exposure to compounds that could dissolve adamantium given enough time. His movements were becoming more desperate as he realized that claiming the rebreather wouldn't guarantee survival in an environment that was rapidly becoming uninhabitable. The toxic sludge reached shoulder level as I struggled toward the chamber's emergency access hatch. Each step required tremendous effort as the viscous waste clung to my legs and the chemical burns across my torso sent waves of agony through my nervous system. The rebreather provided marginally cleaner air, but my lungs were already damaged beyond any hope of full recovery. Pink foam bubbled from my mouth with each exhalation, evidence of the chemical destruction occurring in my respiratory system. Behind me, I could hear the final struggles of my crew members as they succumbed to the toxic environment. Dex's thrashing had grown weaker as his nervous system shut down, the boy's movements becoming occasional spasms that barely disturbed the surface of the chemical soup. Vask continued his pursuit, but his reinforced suit was finally beginning to fail as the corrosive waste found weak points in its welded construction. The emergency access hatch was barely visible through the chemical fog that now filled the chamber completely. The metal surface was streaked with corrosion where toxic vapors had condensed and run down its face, creating patterns that resembled tears on a giant's cheek. The wheel mechanism that should have opened the hatch was green with chemical buildup, its threads seized by decades of neglect and recent exposure to compounds that could eat through steel. I reached the hatch just as the chamber's final emergency light failed, plunging the space into absolute darkness, broken only by the occasional spark from dying electrical systems. My hands found the wheel mechanism by touch, and I threw my remaining strength into turning it despite the agony from Vask's blade still lodged in my back. The metal refused to budge, its corroded threads fused solid by chemical reactions that had been accelerating over the past hour. The rebreather's filters were already showing signs of saturation as they struggled against contamination levels that exceeded their design parameters. The device had been built to handle battlefield conditions, not the concentrated toxicity of industrial waste that had been accumulating for generations. I could taste the metallic tang of chemical breakdown products seeping through the deteriorating seals, a sign that my temporary advantage was rapidly disappearing. Vask's pursuit had ended somewhere in the darkness behind me, his movements silenced by the same toxic environment that was killing me by degrees. The chemical waste continued to rise, fed by the ruptured pipe that showed no signs of reducing its catastrophic discharge. The ancient pump's rhythm had become completely erratic, each mechanical pulse weaker than the last as the machinery slowly drowned in the very waste it had been designed to process. I threw my full weight against the hatch wheel, feeling something tear in my back where Vask's blade had penetrated. The wound leaked blood that mixed with the toxic sludge, creating new chemical reactions that burned like liquid fire. but the wheel remained frozen, its mechanism sealed by corrosion that had built up over decades of exposure to the Underhive's harsh environment. The toxic waste reached my chest as I continued my desperate assault on the sealed hatch. The chemical burns across my torso had reached bone in several places, the acidic compounds eating through muscle and fat with methodical efficiency. My enviro suit existed only in scattered patches now, its synthetic materials no match for the concentrated industrial waste that surrounded me. The rebreather continued its mechanical breathing rhythm, but the filters were making wet, choking sounds as they approached complete failure. I could feel my strength ebbing as the chemical poisoning progressed through my system. The toxic compounds had entered my bloodstream through the numerous wounds and chemical burns covering my body, carrying their destructive work to organs that had previously been protected. My vision was beginning to blur as neurotoxins interfered with the electrical signals in my brain, and my coordination was failing in the same pattern I had watched claim my crew members. The hatch wheel finally gave way under my assault, but instead of opening inward as it should have, the mechanism simply broke apart in my hands. The corroded metal crumbled like ancient parchment, revealing that the threads had been eaten away completely by chemical exposure. Behind the broken wheel, the hatch itself remained sealed, its surface marked by the distinctive pattern of industrial welding that had been applied from the other side. The realization hit me like a physical blow as my damaged brain processed what I was seeing. The emergency access had been deliberately sealed from above, welded shut with equipment that could only have come from the upper levels of the hive. Someone in authority had made the decision to trap anyone in the lower sump systems, preventing contamination from spreading to the productive levels where citizens who actually mattered to the Imperium lived and worked. I hammered my fists against the welded hatch, feeling bones break in my hands as they struck the unyielding metal. The welds were professional grade, applied with industrial equipment that had created seals strong enough to withstand the immense pressures generated by the flooded chamber. Whoever had ordered this containment had possessed both the authority to make such decisions and access to the heavy machinery required to implement them quickly. The toxic waste reached my neck as I continued my futile assault on the sealed hatch. The chemical burns were eating deeper into my flesh with each passing moment, exposing nerve endings that screamed with agony before being dissolved by the acidic compounds. My rebreather was making increasingly desperate sounds as its filters approached complete saturation, the mechanical rhythm becoming irregular as the device struggled to extract oxygen from air that was more poison than atmosphere. Above me, I could hear the distant hum of machinery that spoke of normal hive operations continuing without interruption. The Manufactorums were still producing weapons and ammunition for the Imperial War Machine, their waste products flowing down through processing systems that had been deliberately isolated from the upper levels. The citizens of the mid and upper hive would never know that men had died in agony to keep their waste flowing smoothly, and they would never care if they did know. The mathematics of Imperial society had always been brutal in their simplicity. The lives of Underhive scum like my crew were worth less than the cost of a single bolt round to the Planetary Defense Force. We existed to perform the dangerous work that kept the Hive functioning, and when that work killed us, there were always more desperate men willing to take our places. The Adeptus Arbites had simply applied this logic to its natural conclusion, sacrificing the expendable to protect the valuable. My rebreather finally gave up with a wet, choking sound that echoed my own labored breathing. The filters had reached complete saturation, their synthetic materials breaking down under chemical assault that exceeded their design parameters by orders of magnitude. I was forced to breathe air that was more toxic compound than oxygen, each inhalation bringing fresh poison into lungs that were already dissolving from the inside out. The toxic sludge closed over my head as I lost the strength to keep my face above its surface. The chemical waste filled my mouth and nose with compounds that immediately began eating away at the soft tissues of my throat and nasal passages. I tried to hold my breath, but the damaged rebreather had created a vacuum that pulled the corrosive liquid deeper into my respiratory system. Above me, the ancient pump continued its dying rhythm, each mechanical pulse weaker than the last as the machinery slowly succumbed to the same toxic environment that was killing me. The sound had become a death rattle that echoed through the flooded chamber, a mechanical prayer to the machine god that would go unanswered in the depths of the Underhive. The Emperor's blessing had finally run out in this forgotten corner of his domain, leaving only the brutal mathematics of survival that governed life in the Hive's depths. The toxic waste filled my lungs completely as my damaged respiratory system gave up its struggle against the chemical assault. The acidic compounds began their final work, dissolving the delicate structures that had kept me alive through decades of dangerous work in the Underhive's depths. My last conscious thought was a desperate prayer to the Emperor, a plea for mercy from the same Imperium that had condemned me to this fate through its callous disregard for the lives of those who served in its shadows. The pump's mechanical heartbeat finally stopped as the ancient machinery drowned in the very waste it had been designed to process. In the absolute darkness of the flooded chamber, only the sound of escaping chemical vapors remained, a toxic hymn that would continue long after my body had dissolved completely in the corrosive soup that had once been the Underhive's lifeline.